This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Record-breaking rainfall in portions of Southern California from Tropical Storm Hillary. KNX's Natalie Tavidian reports from Palmdale.
Neighbors say at one point the water was gushing over the 15-foot wall.
Sitting on the couch and I hear just a big boom. Go outside in the backyard to see what's going on, and walking across the street, the water would be up to your knees.
A lot of mud and debris left behind for neighbors to clean.
Air conditioning was on the side of the house and ended up in the front, the back sliding glass door, so the mud took it away.
People are struggling out here, and then we have to deal with this disaster and the cleanup.
She says they had to go to a hotel and might have to stay there for a couple more nights. Despite the massive mess, neighbors say thankfully nobody here was hurt. Natalie Tavidian for CBS News, Palmdale.
The system is hitting portions of Nevada. President Biden and the First Lady get an up-close look at the Maui wildfire devastation. At least 114 people were killed, the president tells survivors.
For the people of Hawaii, we're with you for as long as it takes, I promise you. May God bless all those we've lost. May God find those who we haven't determined yet. And may God bless you all.
Wildfires bring worries to the Pacific Northwest and up to British Columbia. CBS's Nora O'Donnell.
Two major fires burning in Washington state have scorched more than 20,000 acres outside Spokane and forced thousands of people to evacuate. The Gray Fire and Oregon Road Fire have destroyed some 200 structures and are being blamed for at least one death.
Former President Trump says he will surrender to authorities in Georgia on Thursday to face charges in the case, accusing him of illegally scheming to overturn his 2020 election loss. A federal appeals panel says Alabama's ban on hormone treatments and puberty blockers for trans young people can continue. CBS's Matt Piper.
Judges saying states have a compelling interest in protecting children from drugs, but notes Dr. Jack Turbin, director of the Gender Psychiatry Program at UC San Francisco.
These laws are clearly discriminatory because these medical treatments are banned for transgender youth for gender dysphoria, but still allowed for cisgender kids who are using these medications for other conditions.
Major medical groups, including the American Medical Association, oppose the bans, saying treatments are safe if properly administered. Matt Piper, CBS News.
A 19-year-old Ohio woman convicted of a double murder has been sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole in 15 years. Mackenzie Shirillo was convicted of killing her boyfriend and a mutual friend on July 2020 by driving her car into a building at 100 miles per hour. Christine Russo is the boyfriend's mother.
Her actions were controlled, methodical, deliberate, intentional, and purposeful. This was not reckless driving. This was murder.
This is CBS News.
Hire with minimal effort and max speed with Indeed. Their hiring solution platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates efficiently. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Let's be real.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. According to a Wisconsin Policy Forum report, teacher turnover reached its highest levels in 13 years in 2023. A new report states researchers found an average of 11.5% of the state's teachers turned over each year between 2009 and 2023. However, in the most recent school year, that rate rose to 15.8%. The report also found teachers of color had substantially more turnover compared to white teachers, and turnover was most prevalent in districts serving vulnerable student populations. The Wisconsin Department of Transportation is warning drivers that the extreme heat forecast for Wisconsin this week could create conditions for pavement buckling. DOT officials are advising motorists to be alert and take extra caution. A news release says when very hot conditions occur, it causes the pavement slabs to expand and push against one another. And if the pressure becomes great enough, the pavement can buckle and create unexpected bumps or dips in the road. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
If you care about animals or crops, you probably care how the weather could impact both.
It's summer in Wisconsin, and the success of your efforts often depends on knowing the forecast. Count on your local Civic Media weather team for all the information you need.
Crops' roots are also growing deeper in search for water, which is bad news, because when rain finally falls, it will sit shallow and be absorbed in the top layers of the soil.
Your weather and more for your part of Wisconsin.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the app. The Devil Devil's Advocates Radio.
The entire light beer industry is under attack from the right at this time. Apparently, that they no longer have women in bikinis selling the beer.
I would suggest, and this is on the Fox Entertainment Network.
I believe it's the Fox News. Well,
well, I just hope I don't get to the Captain Morgan and Diet Cokes, man. That'd be a sad day.
The Devil's Advocates Radio with Dom and Crute. Weekdays 4 till 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
93.5, The Tap. 93.5, The Tap.
As you're seeing right here in this factory.
A building boom, a manufacturing boom, a jobs boom, a clean energy boom. Sounds like a good idea to me. For much more on all of these booms and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site formerly known as Twitter at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank-approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So over the weekend, I came across a video from our good friend John Russell, who did a video for More Perfect Union and went to the Trump rally in Erie, Pennsylvania, and said, hey, you know, I want to talk to some working people. And lo and behold, what I think he found and what we're going to ask him about is, you know, as we've been saying on this show for years, a lot of the people who voted for Trump just wanted... they want a job. They want a good family-sustaining job. Said it all the time. My family, otherwise known as the basket of deplorables, always racist, always homophobic, always misogynistic, always all that stuff. Never bothered to vote. Never. This guy got them out to vote. Why? Because he was going to bring back that standard of living that they lost. He was going to bring back that opportunity for their children. That opportunity to work hard, play by the rules, and get ahead, as we've been talking about. And here to share some thoughts on his experience there at the big rally, I've asked John Russell to come talk with us. He's the owner, editor of the Holler newsletter. You can find that at theholler.co. We'll get links out on social media, how you can check it out. It's class politics for rednecks and hippies. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, you bet, Rick. Thanks for having me on. Excited to talk again.
So walk me through what takes you to the big Trump rally? What motivates you to go and talk to Trump voters?
I grew up in the Ohio Valley, where a lot of those folks are headquartered. I mean, of course, they're all across the country, but the Ohio Valley is unique. The Ohio Valley was a headquarters of labor union politics. It used to be the place Democrats had to win in Ohio to win statewide. Now, you know, my county where I live and bartend went for Trump by 71%. So I bartend there. I'm on the left and I make no bones about it. I don't hide that when I'm in the bar. And, you know, we have political conversations all the time and they don't go how you would expect them to go if you're just watching cable news all the time. It's like you said at the top of the show. A lot of people, if you're clocking into work because you have to do that, you don't have the luxury of not working. You feel in your bones that the system is getting worse and worse and worse and harder to get ahead. And that's how a lot of people in my bar in a county that voted for Donald Trump feel. Had a lot of good conversations in that bar that I thought would be copied over at the rally. Turns out they were.
No, I was not surprised because, look, I've done the exact same thing. You know, in fact, we did a little over a month long tour back before the last election where we went through Iowa and Wisconsin and in places that used to be places that had factories, had identities and had it stripped away from them. And the conversations we had with people were much like you did. I want our identity back. I want our opportunities back. Was there anything that surprised you when you were talking to the people wearing the Trump, you know, paraphernalia? Anything that grabbed you, said, you know, why are you wearing that outfit if you believe that? Anything like that?
There was a ton of stuff like that. Listen, I mean, it wasn't all, you know, sunshine and rainbows,
no,
right?
Of course,
I mean, people, you know, we talk about meeting folks where they are. All right. We are in a place in America where we've had 50 years of a billionaire funded right wing megaphone that is whispering into the ears of millions of people, you know, especially Trump voters are tuning in and they're hearing a lot of ways that they're supposed to feel about, you know, other Americans. Right. And when you go up there and you ask them, you uncork a bottle of the strongest opinions that are coming straight off of cable news. Once those run out and you say, hey, how's your health care? What's your job like? Are you getting into, you know, are you getting out of work, everything that you're putting into it? You hear a lot of surprising stuff, especially for people wearing red hats. We heard that, you know, the Cheneys took us into Iraq on a lie, that Halliburton is evil big red, and how, you know, we talked to a gas pad worker who was down in West Virginia working for Halliburton, said, I bring multi-millions of dollars of gas out of the ground every day. I get paid $13 an hour, and it's garbage. It didn't take long to find people in line. You know, keep in mind, this is one Trump rally, but didn't take long to talk to people in line and hear that politicians should be rejecting donations from billionaires, that we lost our Republican living in oligarchy, that BlackRock and Vanguard have, you know, close to $20 trillion in assets, and that's way too much. All of these things we heard from people standing in line at a Trump rally, and to me, it just underscored that across the political spectrum, people know that if you're working class, you're getting screwed. They want to do something about it, and if there's a party that wants to organize them along, you know, labor lines, make sure they stick together with other people despite their differences, you could get a long way doing that.
No, and this is what, you know, I had a conversation a little earlier with a woman from Alabama saying, look, you know, the party that figures out how to address her concerns, that her kids don't have the same opportunities she have, that their lives are going to be much more difficult than hers was, the party that figures out how to message that better and actually get something accomplished, they're going to be the ones that, you know, people are loyal to, much like FDR and the Democrats of the 30s and 40s. But we're in such, and you pointed it out, we're in such a polarized time where the media structure is controlled by massive wealth that it's almost impossible for that message to break through. Because look, I've been saying what we've been just talking about since the election in 2016. When everyone's saying, yeah, you know, Trump's racist and he's all that. Of course he is. Of course they are. Of course those people are all racist, misogynist, and homophobic. They've always been. But that's not what motivated them. Was the canary in the coal mine going, hey, the working class is hurting. How about we do something?
Yeah. And, you know, the thing that stood out to me is that we really have for the past 50 years. We've been in this situation where the loudest voice in the room is billionaire-funded right-wing propaganda, right? Before that, when we'd really put up all the latest round of wins for workers, Social Security, Medicare, you know, going back to through LBJ and back to FDR, that was built on, you know, a well of organized labor and people being organized in their workplace. And, you know, since then, it's just been a decline for unions. But I think, you know, two things are interesting here. One, the most positive response we got from talking to people in line was when they heard about how UPS workers, you know, stood in hundreds of thousands of numbers strong, went up against one of the largest, most wealthy corporations in America, won themselves a contract worth $30 billion cash in hand. I mean, there it is, you know, right there. That's a positive example. Everybody in line was down for that. And, you know, to me, it showed that there is potential. There's appetite for a new labor movement. And I think, you know, if that comes to pass and we do a lot of labor organizing, that's the kind of thing that might change the politics right now that we feel are really set in stone.
Yeah,
so let me ask those you kind of politics sold in line.
Let me ask you this, John, because you both of us are labor guys. You know, I for years have been saying that labor has done a poor job of reaching out to people. In fact, when the Tea Party rose, I was telling the leadership of the unions in my area, you should be sending people to take over that movement. That is our voice. That is our movement. And they say, no, they're all a bunch of crackpots. They let it go. They missed another opportunity. We can look through history and see lost opportunity of lost opportunity. And I think the Trump era was another one of those opportunities where labor people who are the most ardent Trump supporters, I think, in this moment.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And, you know, that was another big takeaway from the rally. I mean, Trump is only as strong as his opposition is weak. You know, those people were walking into that rally because they are, you know, fed up with a system that is screwing them in many ways, you know, that are material daily life things. They're paying hundreds of dollars a month for healthcare that doesn't cover anything until you spend thousands of dollars. Rents are through the roof. It's becoming harder to own a home. You know, homes that used to cost, $150,000 or, $500,000, right? People were walking into that rally because they're done with all of that, right? And I think, you know, if labor or a party figures out, that, hey, we could present a labor-left alternative, right, who is anti-establishment. There are clearly chips on the table for that kind of thing. And, you know, if we don't get that together, I think you can expect people to continue walking into Trump rallies.
Well, I mean, you would argue that that was Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, right. We got a lot of interesting answers on that, too. We had one person who said he would rather vote for Bernie Sanders before he votes for somebody like a Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio. You know, these are people who want somebody who's anti-establishment. You know, I think Bernie had to, you know, fight both sides really. And we just don't have a scaled up alternative that can offer something to people who are clearly fed up with how things are.
See, that's interesting to me that some of the Trump folks would go after Sanders, considering, you know, when you think of the Trump people, they're anti-socialist, because, you know, democratic socialist, I wouldn't think would be overly palatable with the red hat on.
You'd be surprised, right? I will say this about the word, you know, there's a lot of staying power in that word socialism, right? But that does fall along age lines. And, you know, I get it. I mean, if you were in grade school, you know, ducking and covering under a desk because the socialists might nuke you, you know, you might have one opinion of that word.
But it wasn't really a socialist I was afraid of nuking me. It was a communist.
Yeah, there you go. Right. So, you know, it all gets scrambled up there. But really, especially when you get into Gen X or millennials and younger than that, it's the scare factor with that word starts to drop off a lot. And I think that could really make politics interesting, you know, the next time that there's a power scramble, because there's an appetite for a labor left kind of candidate.
Do you see anyone on the left, any of the Democratic voices, do you see any Democrats making a play for that space? Because I see Republicans trying to pivot themselves to being the party of the working class. Now they've got no policy wins to share. They've got no policies that they can go, hey, look what we did. But I see them trying to pivot. Do you see anyone on the left trying to do better?
Well, you know, I think there's about a handful of people who are the names that we know that are trying to do that. But I think the better point to focus on is, you know, at a time when there are so many new labor wins. I mean, who thought that we would have any union at any Amazon facility? I mean, we had a warehouse go, regardless of the flaws of that effort, an Amazon warehouse unionized. Why didn't we move the White House there? You know, why aren't we on every single picket line that's coming up to show, as a Democratic Party, this is where our priorities stand? Why aren't we in California, you know, saying to McDonald's workers? I talked to a McDonald's workers in line at the Trump rally. He said, I work very, very hard. I should be paid more. I'm looking at all these union wins out there and thinking maybe this is for me. You know, that's what we should be doing in California right now. Why aren't our younger candidates who clearly have their eyes on the presidency making a principal stand with McDonald's workers right now. I mean, there's no shortage of opportunities for the Democratic Party, if they want to fix their working class problem, to start showing up on picket lines and making no bones about where they stand.
Right, let me see. Let me check the official watch. How long has it been since I've been calling for an Adopt a Striker program? because look, this is not new. This is like, you know, get out there and Obama, wear your comfortable shoes. You know, get out there and march with the working people. And this is where I think the party has had such a problem. Of you know, being identified as the party of working people. And it's frustrating to me because I like some of the policies. I like some of the things Biden has done to this point. I think, you know, the manufacturing stuff, the chip stuff, the infrastructure, most certainly, even though I waited in traffic way too long today and over the weekend. But still, moving in a good direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I want to address one of the pushbacks here. You know, in all of the conversation that we're having right now, you know, the video was a little bit successful, but some of the best critiques there are like, yeah, you know, these things that Trump supporters are saying are surprising, but try that as a person of color in line. You know, that's a good point. But I think, you know, we shouldn't be burdening people of color with going out and rescuing the craziest white people at the Trump rallies, right? That's a job for somebody like me. And the other thing is that, you know, people are looking for answers in this system that they feel is broken, and they're heading into political rallies. But we haven't really pushed out the idea broadly to the masses that there's another field that's not politics, and it's the workplace, right? If you want to get over a lot of these cultural divisions, there's no better way than to put people in this with big differences in the same boat, fighting for themselves against the CEOs, the bosses, especially at a really large company. You know, class solidarity, class unity, that requires people to understand differences and respect each other enough to stick together when people try to divide them, right? So, you know, if we're trying to get over a lot of these culture war issues, we got to throw people into the same boat and make sure they respect each other enough to fight and stick together and win things like UPS. And Trump voters are there. They're ready to go.
You're preaching to the choir on this one. I mean, I've been saying, if you want to reunite the country, we got to reunionize. Because look, you know, people in the same workplace may not agree on all issues, but they got one thing in common. They want to be able to feed their kids and keep a roof over their head. And that is a good place to start. And then you can build from there, which has been my premise for a lot of years. So, you know, the question then becomes, yeah, how do we get to that point? And how do we change the laws to make it easier for people to organize and get contracts and make lives better? That's for me the push forward. So last question I've got, is there any hope for the Trump voters? I mean, I hear a lot of my friends on the left going, you know, there's no hope for them, forget them. And even I've said there's some that are fives that you don't waste your time on. But is there any hope?
I think there is. You know, a lot of people will say, there's a small minority of them that can't be rescued. The rest of them we might reach out to. I don't think it's quite like that. You know, there is, it's cliche, right? But, you know, there's two sides that can be brought out in every single person. And we have had, you know, right-wing propaganda, billionaire funded, that's whose job it is to bring out the absolute worst in people. And the place that we're seeing that most often is these Trump rallies. Okay, but there's another side within people that can clearly be reached when you are talking class solidarity, when you are talking about materially improving their lives. And like we just talked about, when you throw people with big differences into the same boat with a common enemy, I think those people, that is the way to get them to kind of heal across a lot of these cultural divisions. So, you know, we, all of us live in this kind of environment of engineered divisions. And I think, you know, if you're listening to this and you're not on the side of Trump voters, when somebody goes out and produces one of these videos where it's just looking at the zoo animals and picking the craziest person and just, you know, kind of dunking on the Trump voters, hey, you're participating in division of the working class, right? If you want a working class movement, it can't happen with just half the working class, has to be the whole thing. The conversations that we had up there, the willingness and the support for labor action. Those are the things that give me hope. And you know what? If I'm not out of time, I want to close with one thing. I'm sitting in West Virginia right now. Labor history, class solidarity, that is our legacy. That's, you know, not often talked about in textbooks. But in the 1900s, when miners were joining the UMWA in West Virginia, they swore an oath to never discriminate against another worker on the basis of color, because you have to stick together. If you think you're going to win against the 1% and you're going to discriminate, it's not going to hold up very long. You had workers in the South in Kentucky with the Farm Equipment Workers Union. They were marching, they were electing black leadership. They were marching to integrate towns in the South 20 years before Dr. King marched on Washington. That is our history. It's possible to bring it back. And that's the hope that I have after, you know, conversations like this.
No, good stuff, John. I good on you for going. Good on you for the video. I hope folks will take a look at it. But I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon, because I'm with you. I have hope that if we can reunionize, we can reunite. Good stuff, man. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for having me on, Rick. Always good to talk this.
You too, our good friend John Russell. Make sure you check out their website, theholler.co, if you want to check out the great work he does. Quick break, right back with your thoughts. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I got to tell you, I like John Russell's optimism. I really do. And I said that to him before the segment started. One of the things I love about you, John, is how optimistic you are. Because he does. He believes that everyone is reachable, I think. Now, I know some people that I don't think are reachable, but that doesn't mean you don't try. And again, one of the reasons we did our Working Class Heroes radio tour was to go out and talk to people. To get beyond the inch deep talking point, because what you find is, you know, people who just want to focus on it. Here's the talking point, and then to the next talking point, and the next talking point, which is why when someone just comes in, they just blather about a bunch of what about the, and they have their list of grievances. I don't even pay attention to those, because I'm never going to have time to address every grievance. How about we talk about something that you're not going to be so far gone on. And the workplace is that place. You know, we've been saying this for years now. The way we bring people back together is by saying, look, your radical self-interest is involved in being part of this community. The idea that you're going to make better wages, you're going to have better health care, you're going to have better retirement security, you know, that's a huge driver. And, you know, the reason that corporate America has done such a, well, good job of dividing us and have spent so much money dividing us and tearing us apart is because they know that once we come back together, their profit margins go down, their CEO pay goes down, and it ends up like it was in the old days, where people made a decent, reasonable living. And our CEOs... not so much. Now, let me just finish up with this. You go back to this study done. Go back to this study done from 1978 until I think it was like 2019. You had the CEO pay go up, what was it, something like 940, almost 1,000% from 1978. The workers' pay just went up 12% over that same period. Let's quick get a thought in from what is it, Jack from Wisconsin. Jack, you got a thought quick? Okay, well, that's because that's not on.
I figured it right when he said divide and conquer. That's the way to destroy the working class. And he was pretty much right in Wisconsin. What your guest just said, excellent point. We've got to figure out a way to get these people back together again.
I appreciate the thought, Jack. Thanks so much, man. And I'm sure John will be thrilled to hear that. But no, I mean, he's spot on. The way we move forward, we come back together. Again, thank you, Jack. Appreciate it. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1893. That was the day that workers' rights and women's rights activist and anarchist Emma Goldman gave a speech in New York City. Emma Goldman was born in what is today Lithuania. She came to New York in 1885, where she built a reputation as a powerful speaker. In New York, she addressed a crowd of between 3 and 4,000 unemployed workers in Union Square. The country was at the beginning of a depression that would sweep across the nation. Working families were finding it harder and harder to put food on the table. By the end of 1893, unemployment would soar to nearly 20%. Undercover agents at the rally reported that Emma had urged the crowd to take bread from the capitalists, quote, by force. Goldman recounted saying, quote, "Well then, demonstrate before the palaces of the rich. Demand work. If they do not give you work, demand bread. If they deny you both, take bread." 10 days later, Emma was arrested in Philadelphia for her comments at the New York rally. She was sentenced to 1 year in prison. After she was released, Emma traveled to Vienna to study medicine. She returned to the United States to continue her lectures on workers and women's rights. She spoke out about the need for women to have access to contraception, an opinion that could arouse a backlash at the time. Emma was arrested multiple times for daring to speak out on controversial issues. In 1919, during the height of the Red Scare anti-communist hysteria, Emma Goldman was deported to the Soviet Union. Emma was a courageous defender of free speech, often called the most dangerous woman in America. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Today's train robbers don't need guns, for they are railroad executives wearing $3,000 suits and robbing us by railroading the political system. With their gangs of lobbyists and hopper cars of campaign cash, they get Congress to do their dirty work, gutting public safety protections and muting railway unions. Thus, rich investors get richer, while regular people are hit by an astonishing level of derailments, injuries, destruction, and death. Witness the horrific wreck of Norfolk Southern's nearly 2-mile-long toxic freight train this year in East Palestine, Ohio. This was a product of the industry's prevailing ethic of profit over public safety, and the American people were outraged by the greed, demanding fundamental reform. U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg weighed in, correctly noting that calls to protect the public have too often, quote, given way to industry pushback and inaction. That must not happen this time, he emphatically declared. You go, Pete. But it is happening. A key reform he pushed was to allow rail employees to report safety dangers without fear of retribution from the corporate hierarchy. Such a close-call reporting program has existed for years, but participation was voluntary. Hello. Out of some 800 American railroad corporations, just 27 chose to volunteer, and all of the big eight freight giants, including Norfolk Southern, refused to join. In the media glare of the East Palestine catastrophe, however, nearly all pledged to support the employee reporting reform. But that was then. Today, the media focus on East Palestine is gone, and the railroad lobbyists and their hopper cars of corporate cash have rolled back into Washington, watering down Buttigieg's safety agreement to nothing. This is Jim Hightower saying, and that's why America's train system won't run right until we fix the crooked political money system that derails progress.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So leave it to crazy Mike Lee, senator from Utah. Evidently, there's a new plot. There's a new scheme by the Biden administration. I guess COVID lockdowns are coming back. I think this is what I'm reading the report. Evidently, Mike Lee spent the weekend, hyping up Alex Jones's conspiracy that Biden's preparing for another lockdown. COVID's coming. Oh, this guy's in the Senate. Tommy Tuberville's the dumbest guy in the Senate, but wow, there seem to be a lot of people vying for that title too. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day. That's our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst Bob Ney, to come share some. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick.
So are we going to have another lockdown? Biden going to put us all in our homes again?
Well, let me ask you this. What was the court settlement against Jones? How much? Do you remember?
It was like $900 million or something outrageous.
Yeah, why don't we do Lee a favor and let's send that out to him if he wants to share misinformation. How about that?
Yeah, but as a senator, don't you have some protections of you can make up nonsense, or would you still?
Well, technically, if you do it on the floor, and like in my case, for example, the government went after something I said, but it was said on the floor, so it can't even be presented in court. So if you say it on the floor.
Okay.
But I don't think he didn't send it out on the floor. He sent it out as information.
Interesting.
And he said over his lifeless body, he said that this will happen. Okay.
Yeah. Well, maybe he can go to Florida.
Look, who knows these days? There, you know, might be something pop up, a new pandemic. I don't know. We don't know.
Yeah, but
but I surely wouldn't want to be doing what he's doing.
Yeah.
Which is to induce panic before there's any, you know, reasonable amount of information that says, oh, here we go again, you know.
Yeah, but isn't that the point, to induce panic, to get the base all riled up in the panties going, here they come again, they're coming for our freedoms? And probably what this is, and I'm not 100% sure, but I'm going to make an educated guess, that somewhere someone is saying, hey, there might be a super bug down the road, something might pop up, maybe we should have a plan in place of maybe how we learn from past mistakes and we do things a little bit differently so that we can address, maybe, possibly, is this, you know, somewhat reasonable thought, maybe?
Well, that would be nice if we could give that gesture to Lee. It's not. He posted a died suddenly.
Yeah. Okay.
And that is a, you know, completely debunked anti-vaccine film.
Yeah.
From the same, you know, same name that had that. And it was talking about unexplained deaths. And the film was produced by a, you know, far right media guy who also did a QAnon related film, all right, which was talking about vaccines containing synthetic snake venom. Should I go on?
No.
Should we just send this to Mike Lee? Let's do that.
We gotta stop.
Okay.
There's other things that I gotta get to.
Gotcha.
Because we've already spent too much time on craziness.
I thought once I got to the snake venom that'd do it.
You've lost me.
Yeah.
I gotta get to the House Kook Caucus, the Freedom Caucus people. Are we heading for another shutdown?
You know, I want to rename them the Caveman Caucus. How about that?
Yeah, okay.
I like that. Okay. Well, look, the biggest, and I praise them for this. The biggest, not the Freedom Caucus, when the Republicans took control, the one thing that they did that is good is to reestablish bill by bill of appropriations. You know, we did 11, and I think 13 is what they were talking about. That's a good process for anybody to use. So right. I thought, wow, this is great. That's responsible government. Now, that didn't happen. I think one bill made it. So they're going to do the punt by September, you know, end of September. They're going to do the punt, which is to, you know, do what they do, continuing resolutions, which they've done in the past. Now, this is what's weird. McCarthy should have done every single thing he could have done to have gotten those 13 appropriation bills through, because he could have had his fights at the point of the amendments and the bills, and it would have went over to the Senate. Then it was the Senate's problem. Instead, the whole ball of wax is the House's problem. So today, the House Freedom Caucus, drew their red line. And, you know, there's now, what, 36 of them, or, I don't know, 25 or so. And what they said is they're going to oppose any short-term stopgap unless leadership meets their demands. So now what they've done is not only to not do the appropriation bills, now they're going against stopgap unless their demands are met. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to do 13 appropriation bills by these demands in, you know, one resolution that is a short-term funding cap.
Right.
You know, it's what they're doing.
But ultimately in this, you know, and to be, you know, quite frank, you know, this is more, you know, it's, I don't think it's much, as much about funding as it is their political, their want list, their wish list. They want, you know, they want the Secure Borders Act of 23 to cease, you know, to shut off our borders. They want to address the weaponization of justice, the Justice Department, the FBI, mm-hmm. to go after mm-hmm. real criminals instead of them. And they, according to them, want to end the left's cancerous woke policies in the Pentagon, undermining our core warfighting mission. That's really what this is about. I don't buy they care about spending. I think they want a recession. I think they want Biden to look bad. And, oh, by the way, they want to use these buzzword things to get their base all riled up. That's what it seems to me as an outsider. I'm curious if you agree.
This isn't about spending. Again, there should have been 13 appropriation bills. Now, here's the big mistake of Speaker McCarthy. Rick, let's say, for example, that he brought forth all 13 bills, right?
Right.
And let's say of the supposed 36 members, I count more hardcore 20 that would go together on a vote. Let's make it 23. So let's say McCarthy brings up spending bills one at a time, which he did the one bill. And they do the sexy, spicy amendments. Just Freedom Caucus doesn't like it, but they do some. And all of a sudden, you've got centrist Democrats sitting there, as when I was in Congress, saying, okay, I'm going to vote for that bill. So it's a reaching across the aisle. Maybe you don't get 60 or 70 Democrats, but maybe you get 20. Maybe he picks up some of the Freedom Caucus and he passes, maybe agonizingly, but he passes each bill. Now he's sitting here as a hostage, and you're 100% right. This is not a hostage to spending. If you look at what they want policy all to be put into a temporary measure.
Yeah.
This a temporary measure, if you're going to do such a thing, which I think is appalling that they're doing it, if you're going to do a temporary measure, you don't rewrite law in temporary measure. You take what you did. We've historically done that. And you add a few things. Yeah, people will put some riders in. They're trying to do their whole philosophy and point of view and what makes their base get excited in one piece of legislation that's a temporary piece of legislation. It's not about spending.
No, it's about holding the country hostage, as it's always been, as it's been for years now. There's nothing new in this, because again, they never come out with any way to really address the situation, and we just keep kicking this can down the road. I wish we could spend all day wishing and hoping with this kind of insanity would end, because it's not good for us.
They were supposed to do that. McCarthy repeatedly said that he will not. He said this. He's on record. he said, I will not take up what we'll call it. He calls it omnibus. You know, I call it a continuing resolution. He said, I will not take up an omnibus spending package. He's going to do all 12 they had. I thought it was 13. They've got 12, and they're going to roll them into one big piece of legislation, which is okay.
Yeah.
That's what they do. And then the Senate does that. And that's not what they did at all. And so he put himself, you know, at risk with his caucus holding him hostage. Now he's got to definitely not acquiesce to what they want. And the reason he can't acquiesce to what they want, because he can't pass a spending bill. Because he's going to lose Republicans if everything they want is in that bill. So he's got to do a temporary bill that gets Democrat votes. Has to.
Yeah, and there's a short period of time to do this. So any chance we're looking at a shutdown, or does this get done?
I don't think they will. I think in the end McCarthy will do a clean omnibus or clean, you know, continuing resolution that will appeal to Hakeem Jeffries and the Democratic caucus, at least some of them,
right,
to do it just like they've done in the past with the Republicans, a temporary spending measure. But if he loads that up, he may have trouble even getting votes out of his own caucus.
Well, let's see how this plays out. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman and political analyst. I got to get your thoughts on the big story, the $200,000 bond, Trump in Georgia. This is kind of a big deal, isn't it?
Well, you think he's going to have to sell some Mar-a-Lago furniture?
Or maybe, you know, some ashtrays he took from the White House?
He can borrow some money from Mohammed bin Salman.
Oh,
you know.
That stings.
With the golf, you know, with the golf courses and everything.
The LVI or LIV or whatever it is?
MBS. He likes, I call him Mr. Bonesaw. And Mohammed bin Salman, obviously I'm not going to get a visa to Saudi Arabia after this.
Nor should you want one.
No, shouldn't. Correct. But just in case, I'm not going to get one. But, a $200,000 bond. I mean, you know, he's putting a bond out. I don't know. I kind of even thought maybe it would be higher. But then again, if the judge went too high, I don't know. You know, $200,000.
Yeah. Is it a big deal?
I don't think so, because he's not going to go anywhere. He can't. If he left, all of his assets would be frozen if he left the country. So he's not going anywhere.
Yeah. Because I had some people tell me it was punitive. They shouldn't have done it.
It's nothing.
All right. Finally, I got to get your thoughts on, because someone had also asked me if it starts turning south, does he make a quick trip to Russia? And I'm like, no, I don't ever see that. But I did see that the U.S. Embassy in Belarus is telling all the U.S. citizens to gather the sheep and get the flock out, because, things could turn south quick there, I guess.
Well, sure. I mean, I think at any point in time, it can go in a bad direction. There's absolutely no question about that. Any point in time, it could. The U.S. citizens, they've actually told not only the embassy, but they've told U.S. citizens to depart immediately and depart across the borders into, I think it's Lithuania, or go by plane.
Yeah, Latvia and Poland is where they're saying, you know, get to those places quick.
And see, they won't allow U.S. citizens to enter Poland over land from Belarus, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh. The U.S. citizens are not permitted to enter Poland over land from Belarus. So what they've got to do, they've got to take a plane to somewhere, and they have warned them that the remaining border crossings should be done with Lithuania, Latvia, or by plane, and they can't actually enter Poland over land. I don't know what happens to them if they do, but they can't. So the U.S. Embassy in Minsk is saying, hey, you better get out now.
Yeah, I even had a friend tell me that we still got Americans in Russia, and I'm going, why?
Right. Oh, Lithuania is shutting the border down, by the way.
Right.
On top of everything. Yeah, there are people in Russia. Well, I mean, we have Americans that are in Iran. People go there. I mean, there's all kinds of Americans in Russia.
All righty. Well,
I'd be very careful if I was an American in Russia.
Don't lock
any
open windows.
Right.
Wow. But, Bob, I appreciate the time. Great stuff, as always.
Thank you.
Our good friend Bob Ney. Seriously, I have no idea why you would be in those places at this period. Let's quick go to the phones. We've got Justin on line 2. Justin, how are you?
Hey, I'm all right. Thanks for taking my call.
Anytime. What's on your mind?
I guess I just kind of got a question, kind of like a history type question. Nowadays, you know, we have this, everybody's going through this struggle right now. Not everybody's making a whole lot of money. People are working a lot of hours. And I know that history repeats itself. So this has happened in the past. I was just wondering if the population, because like a lot of people are not having kids, you know, because they're not making enough money. They can't afford a house. They can't afford this. They can't afford that. Why would they want to have kids? Why would they even want to date? I mean, it's a big thing on YouTube, you know, a lot of these dating things and people not having kids. But I was just kind of wondering if in the past, I mean, I know that, you know, a lot of immigrants show up to, so it's not like the population's going completely all the way down. But I was just kind of wondering in the past if there was something similar that like people stopped, you know, having children and stuff. Just wondering.
No, that has happened. And as you've said, you know, here in this country, when that happened, we filled those voids with immigrant labor and through massive waves. I mean, there are a number of times throughout the history that that's happened. So, you know, the thought is we're going to be able to fill our borders or fill our country with, you know, lower age workers. It's just that, you know, right now we're talking about putting up borders so no one can get in. That's the weird part. And we're not really in the upside down problem yet that China is in, I don't think. I know a lot of people are saying, Musk's saying everyone should have, you know, 5 or 6 kids. I don't know how we're going to support that, but it's an interesting question. It's something I should look into a little bit more.
Yeah, okay. All right. Yeah, I know, because I was watching things on other countries too, like Japan is having a serious problem in Korea. But yeah, I thank you for taking my call and have a good one.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it, Justin. No, I mean, I've seen some of this stuff as well where, you know, look, you know, you have an older population. Who's going to take care of them? You know, and, you know, fortunately, we've got a very large, you know, millennial Gen Z population coming up behind. As the boomers are dying off, you know, things will, you know, hopefully level out a little bit. But I think our problems are much bigger than age demographics at this point. I think a big part of our problem is you know, it's wealth inequality. It's the fact that, you know, what we have has been divvied up, you know, so unequally that so few have so much. And I know that sounds, you sound like a socialist. No, that's not the point. You know, if you're going to have a competitive capitalist system, you know, the idea of capitalism is to be able to, you know, to abstain. You know, a free market is all about being able to participate or not. And, you know, once you have to work and you have to work for poverty wages, things don't get better until you organize. That's simple. And I fear we're in one of those ruts right now. And I get the feeling we're swinging up. But interesting question. Something I'm going to spend a little more time looking into. I'm going to take a quick break, right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1831. That was the year Nate Turner led a slave rebellion in Southampton, Virginia. From a young age, Turner believed he had a purpose ordained by God. Turner had learned to read from one of his master's sons. He had also learned a deep hatred of slavery from his mother. He came to be regarded as a spiritual leader, or a prophet, by many of the nearby enslaved people. In February of 1831, there was a solar eclipse. Turner took it as a sign that it was time to lead a revolt. He began to make plans. Then, along with 7 other enslaved people, he killed the entire family that owned his plantation. The group made their way from plantation to plantation, killing 51 whites in all. Their plan was to raid the town of Jerusalem. But before they could reach the town, they were met by a militia of 3,000. The small band of between 60 and 75 insurrectionists were no match for the militia. More than 50 slaves were executed. Many more were beaten. Some were from as far away as neighboring North Carolina and had nothing to do with the uprising. White hysteria swept the South. More repressive slave codes were passed in many states.
harsher restrictions were enacted against enslaved people for preaching, being educated, and assembling in large groups. That year, Virginia, Maryland, and Florida all passed laws restricting even freed black men from carrying a gun. Nate Turner escaped the militia into the Dismal Swamp. He stayed there for 6 weeks before he was discovered. He was tried, convicted, and hung. Many historians credit Turner's rebellion and the harsh repression that followed in hastening the coming Civil War and the end of the slave labor system. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I want to finish up today with an email from Terry that grabbed my attention. I've got a bunch of emails today I've been flipping through, but this one got my attention. Said, "Hi, Rick, thanks for having Jessica on. She's just like one of my best friends, served in the military for 25 years in Germany, led a sheltered life, and wouldn't listen to me about what was happening here. When my friend retired, she couldn't believe how much the U.S. has changed. She's currently lamenting being part of the military-industrial complex. Like you, Rick, I'm a Gen Xer. I followed my dad into General Motors. I believed, as you did, work hard, save your money, get promoted, retire with a great pension. I watched all the outsourcing and turning of pensions into 401ks. I was downsized one too many times and left automotive for consulting, then solar. I have no pension like my parents have. I don't have all the answers, but I agree with you about corruption. It chaps my behind to see what leading Republicans and several Supreme Court justices are doing. She says, I want term limits. George Washington believed them. I think she was talking about for the Supreme Court. Mostly, I want to get rid of Citizens United and make campaign contributions totally transparent, for starters. The founders never envisioned career politicians or two-party systems. Maybe she was talking about term limits in general. They did anticipate Teflon Don, so we have to stick to the Constitution and make him accountable for being the narcissistic twit that he is and all his co-conspirators. Meanwhile, I'm doing everything I can do to educate the younger people I work with about history, fair labor practices, and politics, while showing them that not all of us older folks are climate-denying rich buttheads." Okay, yeah, I'm going there with you, Terry. As I said, I'm not in favor of mandatory term limits for the reason that I think we have the ultimate term limiter, and that's our ability to vote. My problem with term limits is at the end of the term, you get the other effect. You get people who are going to vote for something going out the door to enrich themselves in their next position. We saw that in Michigan when Michigan passed right to work. That for me was the moment I said, I'm not on the term limit bandwagon because I want someone to be responsible for me for votes that they take. What are you going to do to somebody as they're voting on the way out the door? They got nothing to stand for. So that's my problem with term limits for electorally. Now, you know, sadly, you're right. There are some people who, and the reason that I reached out to Jessica was plain and simple. I wanted to know why now this epiphany. And now it makes a lot more sense. Because families have been struggling for a very long time. And when you listened to her say what the solutions are, it's interesting to hear that, you know, talking about old school kind of FDR New Deal Democratic ideals. You know, there are, every problem there is out there, we can solve with sound policy and smart investment. We can. You know, the housing crisis, there aren't enough houses. Well, we could say we're gonna encourage the building of more homes. And you can do as they did back in the 50s, you know, with public money, went to private contractors, and they built entire communities. My grandparents lived in one. It was that whole community was built up in a couple of years of little brick bungalows. I'll get it out, and affordably priced, well built, and you know the reality is came with a small profit margin, but a profit margin for the contractor, not an exorbitant, not an incredibly huge one, but they made money. But what they did is they built for the good of society, and you know, to be honest, housing prices were made reasonable by increasing the flow. Now she was spot on. She said, look, you know, the reality, reason rents are so high, big money people buying them up. The fact that she went to foreign investors and hedge funds, good on her, man. Because that's the reason our rents are so high. When Alex Rodriguez goes, the former baseball player, goes on a TikTok or a, whatever the social media platform and says, I'm going to have 150,000 doorknobs. One guy is going to own 150,000 addresses that he's going to rent out.